Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This is the day we talk about recent data sets on acute myeloid leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes. We have a great faculty, Dr. Umar Barade from The Ohio State University, the James Cancer Center in Columbus, Ohio, and Dr. Andrew Wei from the Melbourne Hospital, University of Melbourne, the Walter and Lazai Hall Institute of Medical Research in Melbourne, Australia. Actually, Andrew's coming to us from tomorrow morning here today. We're going to be talking about tomorrow in terms of AML and MDS as well. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by the faculty, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we always do, there's a very short 10-item question that you can take before and after the meeting, and you'll get a lot more out of this webinar if you take that. We'll learn a little bit about you. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. You're into audio programs. Check out our podcast series, Oncology Today, including a recent program with Dr. Richard Stone from Dana-Farber talking about AML and MDS data sets presented at the recent ASH meeting. We do webinars all the time. On April 12th, we'll be working with Dr. Hurwitz and finishing out our ER-positive triple-negative breast cancer series. And then on the next day, the 13th, we'll be tackling the topic of non-small cell lung cancer and focusing on immunotherapy and other non-targeted approach, particularly, of course, checkpoint inhibitors. We'll finish out, we'll be doing our year in review program on colorectal cancer on April the 19th. We'll have a bunch of papers to talk about there. And then in 3 weeks, we're heading out to make our annual trip to the Oncology Nursing Society annual Congress. So for your nurses and nurse practitioners who are watching today, or those of your colleagues, we're doing a 10 symposia there over 4 days. We always do a whole bunch of them, and we're really looking forward to working with them this year. But today we're here to talk about AML and MDS. And as we do in general on our year in review series, I meet with the faculty separately. And so we had 2 sessions, one with Andrew and the other with Uma, where we recorded an in-depth presentation covering a lot of papers and presentation from the past year. We're not going to go through all that today. Today we're going to try to take it to the next level in terms of where all this stuff might be heading. But here are the papers that Andrew covered in AML. You can see there's a whole bunch of them covering a lot of new developing issues in AML. We're just going to do a little bit of a tasting menu and hopefully get you interested enough to go ahead and check out his presentation. And then for MDS, again, a whole bunch of papers covering a number of issues. We're going to just, again, sort of take a view, a 10,000-foot view of all these papers, particularly from the point of view of the general medical oncologist. So first we'll start out with the AML papers, then we'll take a breath and just sort of reflect back on the whole concept of AML and the general medical oncologist, our primary target audience, and what some of these papers mean. We'll be doing the same thing with Uma on MDS as well. So here are the topics, or some of the topics that Andrew covered in his talk, and we're just going to sort of cruise through them and get his global take on them. The issue of, and here's the way Andrew's agenda is. I love this. He actually went through, this is actually his agenda as he goes through all these papers in terms of where the disease is, particularly breaking things out based on whether they're younger, fit patients or older, unfit for intensive chemo, first line or salvage. We're going to just sort of take a look at some of them. And of course, Andrew, for the last few years, one of the biggest stories in medicine and oncology in general has been HMA venetoclax. You certainly have been in the middle of it. You previewed or talked about a number of papers focusing not only on the older patient with HMA venetoclax, but also now we're starting to see papers, including your work, combining venetoclax with intensive chemotherapy. What's the bottom line, Andrew, in terms of globally, where are you seeing things heading? First of all, for the patient who's not a chemo, high-dose chemo candidate, and second, these intriguing trials trying to bring venetoclax up front for the younger patients.
Thanks, Neil. For the older patients with AML who still make up the vast majority of our diagnosed patients, venetoclax really has changed the landscape. We had 50 years of chemotherapy trials with just zero progress in this group. And now we have a drug which in combination with AZA gives us response rates of over 60%. And these two studies now explore what is the potential curability of these agents in this group of patients. With the first analysis, particular VIALE-A, we had a plateau of around 40%. It made us wonder, how many of these people are going to be cured? Now with follow-up exceeding 3 years, we can see that the long-term survival is looking at around 15%. So I think the message is that the majority of patients will progress at some stage. However, there have been some molecular studies now breaking these patients into three defined groups, one with higher benefit, a group that doesn't have a lot of benefit, and a group in between. And I think it's the group with the higher benefit, that is those who don't have a FLT3 mutation, don't have a RAS mutation, and don't have a P53 mutation, where the two-year survival is, is exceeding 50%. So those are the patients we really have to look after properly, avoid toxicity, and make sure they get the most benefit out of this regimen. I think that also applies to the low-dose ROC Venn study, where NPM1 mutant patients, again, two-year survival exceeding 50%. So these are the group that have the most benefit, we realize now, from these therapies.
So, one of the things, you did the VLEC study looking at low-dose ROC. I'm curious, Andrew, do you actually use that regimen outside a trial setting in your practice? In the United States, that's not a common regimen to utilize.
Yeah, I started using both of those regimens right when the initial trials were both done. And so I had the fortunate opportunity to experience both first up. The low-dose ROC-Ven regimen is really well tolerated. There's a lower rate of febrile neutropenic complications. But the activity in adverse risk AML, I think, is inferior to the AzaVen, and that's why the AzaVen has become more popular in its use. However, the low-dose ROC-Ven regimen, I still think, has a very useful role in the NPM1 mutant patients, because even compared to Ven-Aza across studies, the response rate seems to be a little bit higher, deliverability is good, and the molecular clearance rate is 50% of NPM1 by high sensitivity MRD with LODAC Ven, which is similar, if not a little bit better, than AzaVen.
So before I ask you about the issue of venetoclax in the younger patients, just to come back to you, Uman, asked that what I call the DiNardo question, because I ask Courtney this every time we work with her, which is, any sort of advice to the general medical oncologist using HMA venetoclax about when to do a bone marrow and when to hold the venetoclax?
I think that's a great question. And I think we have learned now over the years that you really want to look early and you want to be cautious with the venetoclax. And so I almost treat HMA-Ven in cycle one as a true induction regimen. We do a bone marrow biopsy, as they did on the VLEA study, after that first cycle to see how the patient has responded. And then we wait for count recovery and adjust the dose of venetoclax in that second cycle so as to avoid prolonged cytopenias and keep the patient at a consistent dose and schedule.
So, yeah, that's kind of the message we've been getting the last year or so. Andrew, what about this exciting work that you've been involved with looking at venetoclax in the younger patients?
Yeah, so after the success of the low-intensity studies, we performed the first combo study with intensive therapy in patients over the age of 65. It was with the 5-2 intensive regimen, and Courtney has followed that up along with many other groups with more intensive regimens in younger people. We found that, surprisingly, intensive chemo plus Ven was well tolerated, and particularly in our elderly study, count recovery was actually surprisingly similar to intensive chemo without venetoclax. What we do know, however, is that these regimens, regardless of whether young or old, that the ability to deliver recurrent cycles of intensive therapy with Ven is problematic and cumulatively associated with severe myelosuppression. So I think my main message is to consider these regimens in patients where you have a transplant lined up and ready to go, because occasional patients will have almost irrecoverable bone marrow suppression that without a transplant could be quite dangerous. So do not think of this as a scenario where you can use 4 or 5 cycles of induction and consolidation. This is a big hit treatment with a goal to getting a patient into remission and into transplant.
So we're going to go on to the next topic. Uma, any thoughts or questions about that?
No, I completely agree. And I completely agree with Andrew's note of caution. If you are going to do this, make sure you have that transplant donor lined up.
So, Andrew, another thing that you commented on was some data presented at the last EHA meeting on, maybe I'm the last person to hear this sort of nickname, but I like the Dex-C. I mean, that's, you know, I can never pronounce acetazurazine and Dex-C. I love it. But anyhow, can you just talk a little bit about this study, which we learned a lot from, and your thoughts about its relevance to AML?
Yes, this was a really nice study, which really delivered an oral hypermethylating agent very rapidly into clinic by doing this very nifty pharmacokinetic study where they compared the oral agent versus conventional intravenous decitabine for the first cycle. Then they crossed over and gave the other one for the second cycle, and then everyone got the oral decitabine cetazuridine therapy, which is a combo one tablet, which really combines the decitabine with the cetazuridine, which reduces its metabolism and enhances its activity. So really, we now have the option of using an oral agent, which obviously brings enormous convenience to patients not having to come in and have an IV infusion. My colleagues, however, tell me, who have used this a lot more than I have in the US, that perhaps the 5 days of the oral decitabine cetazuridine is quite myelosuppressive. And some of my colleagues are even drawing it back to a 3-day treatment per cycle. So yeah, I'd be keen to hear Uma's experience with this regimen.
Yeah, I'm curious about that also as well, Uma. And also, you know, it kind of seemed like, you know, when the pandemic came, we were all like crazy. How do we keep these people out of clinic? And then when things started to calm down and it seemed like people were thinking, I'm like, well, they still don't want to come in, even though, you know, maybe COVID is not so much of a risk. First of all, any thoughts on how much this will change the patient's quality of life, Uma? And then any thoughts about, again, if you're going to do this approach, which how many days or what regimen specifically?
So I will say I completely agree with your comments about the pandemic and, you know, what that pushed us to do. And I think it pushed us to very quickly innovate and change to as many regimens or the way we dose drugs to keep patients at home. And this was a huge reason this regimen was adopted quickly once this data came out. I think for the patients that have, you know, that take this regimen, they do endorse the quality of life is better. They don't have to come 5 or 7 days in a row, you know, to the infusion center. They don't have to be, you know, poked and prodded to get IVs and shots. I do think, though, people should be aware it is, you know, real chemotherapy. It is equivalent to IV decitabine, as you can see on the slide. So the counts do drop. So patients do have to come in. They do have to get their counts checked regularly. They do need transfusion support. And in terms of how many days, we typically start off with 5 days, but it's not uncommon to reduce the patient fairly quickly to 4 and down to 3, as Andrew just mentioned.
So let's talk a little bit about FLT3, and there's a lot we could talk about here, but we definitely need to talk about Quantum first, Andrew. This was presented last summer, and, you know, everybody was kind of scratching their head about what's this going to mean. It looked, you know, indirectly, it seemed a lot like what we had seen with Midostaurin. Can you just provide an overview of the design of the study, who went in the study, and your global take on the outcome and what you think it means to practice?
Yes, this is a major study whereby patients with FLT3 ITD, because this drug only targets ITD and not TKD FLT3 mutant patients. And patients were included from the age of 18 all the way up to 75, so a bit older than the original RATIFY study. And patients got conventional intensive induction and consolidation. and either received quizartinib or placebo, but more importantly, could also receive maintenance, not just post-chemo, but post-transplant. And that's a major point of differentiation from the RATIFY trial. And they could receive maintenance for up to 3 years. And so the trial was a resounding success, met its primary endpoint of improved overall survival. And it's also important because we recently had news that the Morpho study, which was the post-transplant maintenance comparison between gilteritinib and placebo in FLT3 mutant patients, did not meet its primary endpoint. We were all looking and expecting that was to be a positive study and basically consolidate the role of post-transplant maintenance therapy, but it has not done that, but we need to wait for the full details. That said, it's possible that with the Quantum First study providing post-transplant maintenance anyway, and my understanding is potentially on the verge of being approved by the US FDA, that this could in fact just really take over frontline FLT3 ITD in the induction, consolidation, and post-transplant maintenance setting.
And just, I think you mentioned, but I don't know if you did mention that Morpho was looking at gilteritinib, and that, which was, you know, I guess we'll see the data hopefully in the next few months, maybe ASCO, I don't know. But any thoughts before I come to Uma in terms of based on looking at these data, looking at, you know, the prior data with Midas-Thorn, how these two approaches are going to compare indirectly, not only in terms of efficacy, Andrew, but also in terms of quality of life? I hear people talking about the taste or smell of Midas-Thorn. Maybe that's not a big deal or not, but any way to differentiate either tolerability or efficacy from these indirect comparisons?
Yeah, so patients who have FLT3 TKD will still need to receive Midas-Thorn because quizartinib right. won't work in that setting. Both drugs have about a 14% rate of rash with respect to Midas-Thorn and about a 14% grade 3 or higher rate of QT prolongation with a quizartinib. And so those are the two distinguishing adverse events. We probably will switch, I think, to using predominantly quizartinib for FLT3 ITD patients. What we haven't seen from the publication from Quantum First is whether older patients will also derive as much of a benefit as the younger patients. And I think there's always going to be a question mark of whether there are diminishing returns in older people. So I think otherwise, you're right, some people don't tolerate Midas-Thorn well because of its nausea and its taste issues.
Before I ask Uma what her preference would be if it gets approved in the U.S., what has led you all to think you would prefer a quizartinib, Andrew?
Because quizartinib is well known to be probably the most potent direct FLT3 ITD inhibitor we have available, and so the logic is there. The survival has now been demonstrated, and we have access to post-transplant maintenance, which I still think has an important role. And so using quizartinib gives us access to all those stages of treatment, whereas if we use Midas-Thorn, we sort of only have data in the pre-transplant setting.
Uma, any thoughts if this gets approved? Any thoughts about which one you're going to go to for ITD?
I agree with Andrew. I think quizartinib would be my go-to for exactly the reasons he mentioned. And I would add to that, I mean, we do know the toxicity of Midas-Thorn. We're familiar with it. I don't think you underestimated the GI toxicity. I think it's not just the nausea, vomiting, but a lot of patients, when they do get neutropenic from the chemotherapy, you know, have a pretty bad diarrhea. They have sometimes enteritis. And so there's a lot of things with Midas-Thorn that, you know, we've learned to deal with. But if there was a better alternative, which as Andrew mentioned, there is, that encompasses right from induction all the way to post-transplant maintenance, I think that is definitely something I would be interested in adopting for our patients.
So ITD, IDH mutant disease, there's a lot to talk about there. I certainly was surprised when I woke up one day and I checked my phone and there was another IDH inhibitor that was approved. I was like telling the cholangiocarcinoma people because, hey, do you know there's another IDH inhibitor out there? So Andrew, what do we know about? And also, this one needs a good nickname as well. But in any event, olutasidumab, that's about as good as I can do it for the first time here. What about it, Andrew? It's available now. How do you decide between that and ivosidenib?
Yeah, I think in AML, we're now blessed to have a growing repertoire of targeted agents. Ivosidenib, which we have had available with new data at the top there from Palmonosinos showing that it improves event-free and also overall survival in frontline use. So for me, I am going to Ivo-Aza for patients who identify to be IDH mutant AML because this combination is well tolerated, has a low risk of myelosuppression, and can be delivered for a prolonged period with good efficacy. With respect to the new kid on the block, olutasidenib, which was presented and soon to be published with respect to its role in relapse refractory mutant IDH1 AML. The interesting thing is that the response rate is over 40%, and patients have a true CR or a true response. There's a really nice 2-year survival in that group, and an interesting plateau of durable response. And so this is a really interesting drug. Still difficult to know whether to use this or ivosidenib because there's no head-to-head comparison. Tolerability is very similar. And so I think, from my point of view, both are very good options for patients with relapsed refractory disease. Whether there'll be subtle differences in resistance mechanisms because they're slightly different, I think these will be the subtle things that hopefully future studies will reveal to us.
And also tune in to Andrew's talk to get more into IDH as well as FLT3 in the older patient combined with AZA or combined with AZA-VEN. There's a bunch of studies out there. Any comments about this new IDH inhibitor, UMA, and also any comments about differentiation syndrome, you know, in terms of the general oncologists out there? How often do you see it and when do you see it?
So I guess more of a question rather than a comment, and I think we just have to see the data. I was just curious for the new IDH inhibitor, whether patients, they had a cohort of patients in the study that had received ivosidenib, for example, and then gone on to receive the new IDH inhibitor, and whether those patients had a response, and if not, you know, why? As Andrew mentioned, I'm sure there's differences in the drugs and maybe some learnings there. And in terms of differentiation syndrome, I will say I have been fooled several times when I have thought that this patient will not develop differentiation syndrome, or maybe this is not differentiation syndrome. So I have learned to watch for it for several weeks, if not, you know, months into initiating IDH therapy. And I think it can be pretty subtle. Sometimes a patient's just like, oh, I have a cough, or I'm a little short of breath, or my legs are a little more swollen. And that now really, you know, I prick my ears when patients say that, because that could be the start of differentiation syndrome. It doesn't always manifest with high white counts. And sometimes the symptoms can be subtle. So for a general oncologist that might be prescribing this medication, just something to consider.
Andrew, what about this issue of IDH inhibitor after IDH, either way, you know, ivosidenib first or olutasidenib? How about FT2102? Maybe I'll stick with that. Mechanisms of resistance, any reason to think you might see benefit after as a second one?
If someone's had a prior IDH inhibitor and progresses, what we're doing at the moment is, first of all, trying to understand what the mechanism of that failure is. So, for instance, if the patient has an IDH inhibitor, we expect the 2-HG to go down. And if that comes back up again whilst the patient's on therapy, it actually says there's probably been a drug-resistant mutation. And if that's the case, it's possible that subsequent IDH inhibitors may not work. And so I think that's the first thing to work out. The second is that some patients have an isoform switch. So you start off with an IDH IDH1 inhibitor for an IDH1 mutant disease, but the patient might progress because they've evolved an IDH2 mutation. And so reprobing molecularly what's going on is critical because it then lends the use of enasidenib, for instance. And furthermore, all IDH inhibitors are susceptible to resistance mechanisms driven by kinase activating mutations, including FLT3. So again, critical to look for FLT3 because we have really nice targeted agents in that setting as well. So number one, understand the biology. And number two, construct the right therapy for the right patient. And often we're moving to combination therapy if there's no on-target resistance, either moving to an IDH inhibitor in combination with AZA or possibly with venetoclax as well. So we've got lots of great tools, great drugs, but knowledge and rational use is critical.
All right, CPX-351, well, that's been a really interesting story and keeps getting more interesting. And I kind of want, I'm curious to hear from both of you where you think CPX is going to land in 3 or 4 years. But Andrew, can you talk about these papers looking at, I guess, you know, subsets within the you know, prior study to see whether there are other patients who could benefit? And it looks like maybe there are. Can you comment on these papers?
Yeah, so there's two papers here and one other paper, which I'll also mention, which is relevant for CPX-351. So first of all, this paper by Jorge Cortez, looked at patients with adverse risk AML and compared CPX-351 with 7 and 3, demonstrated a higher response, a slight improvement in survival. However, if you look at patients that went to transplant, there was a very strong benefit of CPX-351, where I think 3-year survival was approaching 40 to 50% in adverse risk AML. And so that looks to be an interesting result, particularly if that can be confirmed in future studies. With respect to Jeffrey Wee's presentation of lower intensity CPX-351 plus VEN, this is a feasibility study showing that these two drugs can be combined. And obviously this will lead to further studies probing whether venetoclax can enhance responses in patients who are elderly as an alternative to VEN-AZA. One other study which I think is important and relevant was a UK study presented by Jad Othman at ASH last year, where they actually looked at this new AML molecularly defined MDS entity. So that is AML with mutations in RUNX1, ASXL1, EZH2, et cetera, spliceosomes. And they did an analysis on patients with adverse risk AML where CPX-351 was randomized to flag idarubicin. And there was a very substantial benefit for CPX-351 in that group. And if that can be confirmed in future studies, it opens the possibility for intriguing reclassification of who should receive this from clinical secondary therapy-related AML to molecularly defined MDS-related AML. And so I think that was a really interesting observation.
So any comments, Uma? And also, I hear some people in practice, you know, who don't see that much AML, you know, kind of viewing this as a, you know, more tolerable form of 7+3. But my take of it is, from what I've been hearing from you all, is this is, you know, the same criteria to get 7+3. Is that generally the case? Or are there some patients who you would give CPX to from a tolerability point of view that you wouldn't give 7+3 to?
I think, you know, you have to be what we traditionally call an induction candidate. I mean, you have to have, you know, enough robustness. Your cardiac function has to be adequate because in general, CPX-351 obviously has, you know, a fixed dose of Ara-C and an anthracycline. And so I think we need to be aware that these have to be patients that can tolerate induction. And as Andrew said, the biggest benefit of giving this drug is the fact that patients can move to transplant. So in general, these are fitter patients. However, I do think we tend to utilize this more in our older patients, as was done in this phase 3 study, because we do worry about, you know, tolerability, in general compared to 7+3. And so it is much better tolerated. Patients don't lose their hair, which for some patients is actually quite important. And in general, you know, they do well. However, again, I always caution people, you are going to develop the same type of cytopenias. They're going to be prolonged, if not even more prolonged sometimes than 7+3. And so patients need a lot of support. We do this inpatient. I know some centers do this as an outpatient therapy, but we keep patients inpatient just like we would with induction with 7+3.
So, Andrew, where do you see CPX heading over the next few years, particularly this idea of CPX plus venetoclax? But just in general, what do you think are some of the most promising leads with this agent?
I think the results suggesting that it has potentially an interesting role in this adverse risk group of patients that we want to take to transplant. I think we will use that as a framework to try and build better long-term outcomes. I think the most intriguing possibilities would be if the magrolimab studies are positive in P53 mutant AML, whether some interesting uses of magrolimab with this CPX351, either in combo or sequentially or post-transplant, et cetera. I think having these tools which are showing activity in these poor-risk patients which don't have a huge benefit from intensive chemotherapy alone, I think using new agents is really the way of the future.
Magrolimab and CPX, that sounds interesting. All right, menin inhibitors. We started hearing about this about, I guess, in the last year or two, and sounds like it's getting close to maybe coming into practice, Andrew. Can you kind of give us a little brief on what menin inhibitors are and what we know about them, and if it does get approved, you know, how exactly they're going to be utilized?
Yeah, look, this is an absolutely fascinating area of hematology where bench research, spearheaded by Scott Armstrong's lab, has, you know, really led to the development of a whole raft of targeted inhibitors against menin. So we know that these menin inhibitors are on target because recently we heard at ASH that patients on menin inhibitors can develop on-target mutations which block the activity of the drugs, which is absolute proof that these drugs and this target is relevant for AML. We know that patients receiving menin inhibitors can achieve remissions, a very good rate of remission in people who are completely resistant to prior chemotherapy. And we also know that a lot of these patients that achieve a response also have MRD clearance, which for relapsed refractory patients is a really spectacular result. The field is now waiting to see whether some of these single agent drugs in the relapsed refractory setting will be approved and open the door to broad usage in the standard of care setting. But the research field is already moving these agents into frontline in combination with Ven/Aza and soon in combination with 7+3, and asking the question, will these drugs transform outcomes for patients with poor risk MLL rearrangements and also patients with NPM1 mutant AML?
So there are just three different agents that are listed here. I imagine there are probably others. Any basic differences between these various menin inhibitors, or are they sort of me too?
There are some subtle differences with these agents. So with respect to ziftomenib, the drug appears to be a little bit more active in NPM1 mutant AML. We don't know if that's just small numbers or if that's a real issue yet. SNDX-5613 has some issues with QT prolongation, which you know, the dose has been found, but with the dose that is used, it is very serviceable, very active, and effective. There are covalent inhibitors, and Janssen also has a drug in development. So we really wait to find out which is the best drug, which has the best toxicity profile and which has the most activity. And many of these agents are fairly competitive at the moment. So a bit too early to know which one's going to be the best. They are all in very active phases and all showing promise in different degrees.
I can't remember. I shouldn't confess that. But you see differentiation syndrome with these, Andrew?
Absolutely. This is one of the key observations which actually was expected from the preclinical research studies, that this is a differentiating agent in terms of its mechanism of action. And so like promyelocytic leukemia, like IDH inhibitors, physicians using this new class of drugs have to be fully aware of the risks of differentiation syndrome, early use of steroids, and for patients with a rising white cell count, really to get that down with hydroxyurea or other agents. One fascinating observation, which is just starting to come out, is that these class of agents might have very good activity in patients with extramedullary disease, which I think is really fascinating. For some reason, these drugs seem to concentrate really highly into tissues outside the bone marrow, which opens up the possibility, one, for these agents being used in such patients who often are very challenging, especially post-allograft. And second, these patients with extramedullary disease may also be special candidates for differentiation syndrome. So new drugs, new toxicities, lots of things to learn.
So, yeah, welcome to Medical Oncology 2023. Uma, any comments on these agents? To me, one of the things that maybe is going to be a little challenging if and when it does these come into practice is like exactly what genomic abnormalities you give it for. I guess you just like look it up or something. But any thoughts about how this is going to play out in practice, Uma?
I agree. I think, you know, as Andrew mentioned, the menin pathway is going to be important in many different molecular subsets. But we know that the NPM1 mutated patients and the MLL rearranged patients seem to have the most sort of menin relevance in terms of pathway and in terms of efficacy of these agents. And that's where the drug development is starting. But I agree. I totally believe that as we understand more about the role of menin in AML, that we're going to have to explore these drugs in different subsets of AML and hopefully be able to use them in more subsets of AML, not just NPM1 and MLL rearranged disease.
All right, let's talk a little bit about MDS, and Uma covered this very well. There's some great stuff to really consider. And you started out with an issue that I think is really critical at a global level about MDS, which is the classification, and particularly this new molecular classification that came out last year. Can you comment on that, Uma, and what your thoughts are about sort of what its relevance is going to be?
Absolutely. And I think as a, you know, clinical oncologist, when I have an MDS patient sitting in front of me in the office, the first question, you know, they ask is, well, I know I have this. What does that mean? And I always pull up the IPSS classification. And so far it was the IPSSR, which looked at different variables like counts, blasts, and cytogenetic changes. But we weren't really incorporating molecular mutations, which, you know, as Andrew described in AML, have become pretty much key to defining our therapy. We weren't really utilizing that in prognostication for our MDS patients. So the IPSSM classification did that very elegantly. They, you know, looked at a cohort of almost 2,500 patients and then another validation cohort and showed us that by incorporating molecular mutations, you can actually delineate very nicely different subsets of your MDS patients, right from the very low risk to the very high risk. And compared to our previous IPSSR classification, we were actually probably, you know, understaging about two-thirds of patients, which now would be upstaged. And so clinically, it's valuable to show the patient, well, here's your risk of maybe progressing to AML, you know, survival and so on, and obviously then determining which patients should get what therapy.
I don't know if either one of you ever used adjuvant online, but I'm starting to think you need something, you know, for breast cancer. I'm starting to think you need some kind of model. Maybe you already have one for AML. And, you know, Andrew, any thoughts about this classification issue with MDS, but also the issue of the borderline between AML and MDS, which in the issue of patients with less than 20% blasts, and your vision of how we're going to really approach this? Are we going to approach it as really a continuum in the future?
Yeah, as Uma mentioned, I think this IPSSM information is very useful. So for each patient that I have with MDS, including this patient group with 10 to 19% blasts, what I do is I do the RIPSS and I also do the IPSSM. And if depending on the patient's symptoms or their trajectory and whether they're a clear allograft candidate or they're sort of intermediate, That's sort of where I find that this IPSM is quite useful. So for this patient where they actually have low levels of blasts and they are IPSS intermediate, and I'm not sure if I should just watch them or how closely I should watch them, should I get the transplant ready enough, this really helps me to stratify those patients a bit better. Yep, this is a high-risk patient. I need to start talking to the patient about transplant. And the most important thing I've really noticed, especially with community physicians, is that I sometimes still see patients with 10 to 90% blasts called MDS and treated palliatively. That is, they're on azo or they're on Ven-Aza, but I get referred the patient after 7 or 8 cycles because they started progressing. And I'm thinking, hang on, this patient's only 65. This patient should have been transplanted, you know, 4 months ago. And my key message is, if the patient has a high risk of transformation to AML, or in many cases we can already classify them as AML, this patient needs a different mindset from the physician in order to try and look at the possibilities of cure with new agents that can have a high rate of response, get the patient to transplant and off therapy, rather than just continuing on treatment until progression, which then produces a situation where we don't really have great agents to salvage the patient. So treat the patient with intent right from the beginning. Is this patient potentially on a curative pathway or not?
So tempting with each one of these topics to just keep going, but we're going to try to get through at least, you know, sort of a little bit of each one of these things. And I thought this is one of the most interesting parts of your talk, Uma, is several papers looking really at the issue of low-risk MDS. And from my point of view, the question of when to treat and what to treat with, and particularly now with the press release coming out with luspatercept versus EPA, whether or not where that's heading, also lenalidomide. So can you kind of summarize? Really, the best way is just to go through the talk and all the details, but sort of your global take on this question, Uma.
So I think a summary of the papers that are, you know, referenced on your slide is, in general, right now in clinical practice, when you have your low-risk MDS patient, you sort of wait for them to be, you know, anemic, transfusion dependent, symptomatic, and that's when you initiate therapy. Typically with ESAs, if the EPO is less than 500, if they have ring sideroblasts, SF3B1 mutations, you know, you might prefer luspatercept. And then the goal is to not make them anemic and not have them transfusion dependent and improve their quality of life. So the first paper that's referenced on the slide actually explored, can you start ESAs in the anemic patient before they become transfusion dependent, or maybe they're just mildly transfusion dependent? And they showed that in this study that that group of patients, so patients who are mildly transfusion dependent or not transfusion dependent but anemic, responded really well to ESA therapy. They had a response. Their hemoglobin, you know, went up. They remained transfusion dependent for a prolonged period of time. It impacted their outcomes. And more importantly, I think for our low-risk patients, it really impacted their quality of life. And in the third paper, actually, that you referenced on the slide, the same study was done with low-dose lenalidomide in your deletion 5q patients, where we know lenalidomide has a great response. It has benefit. You can see cytogenetic responses. And they again did this in deletion 5q patients who were not transfusion dependent. They did 5 milligrams of lenalidomide, you know, for 28 days. And they again showed these patients actually did really well. They had prolonged periods of transfusion independence. And they actually even potentially, you know, had improved quality of life. They didn't really have worse infections, neutropenia, their cytogenic responses were good. And so I think the summary to me is, maybe instead of intervening when the patients are symptomatic, anemic, transfusion dependent, as oncologists, we need to think of intervening earlier. And maybe there's a difference in the biological impact of these therapies. Maybe it's the impact on the microenvironment, inflammation, with the immunomodulatory, you know, mechanisms we're learning now, that we're impacting the disease instead of just classifying this as supportive therapy. And then to round off the discussion with luspatercept, we can see from the long-term follow-up of the Medalist trial that patients who actually did get a response to luspatercept appeared to maintain that response for an extensive period of time compared to patients that did not respond. And as you referenced, the COMMANDS study, which actually did a head-to-head comparison between erythropoietin-stimulating agents versus luspatercept in patients who are transfusion dependent and ESA naive, luspatercept in the press release appeared to have a benefit in terms of transfusion independence in these patients. It's just a press release. We need a lot more details. But again, I think the story is maybe intervening earlier potentially could impact our patients more favorably.
Andrew, any thoughts or questions?
Yeah, I think these groups of studies are absolutely fascinating because, you know, we treat AML a lot and, you know, that's a hard job. But maybe we should be looking at trying to prevent or delay AML in our patients. And these studies, which obviously have benefits in terms of keeping patients transfusion-free and a better quality of life for longer, but now these subtle hints of they might be delaying AML, maybe changing the natural history. And then the lenalidomide study, I was fascinated that in the lenalidomide group, there was an 80% clearance of cytogenetic abnormalities versus zero in the placebo group. And, you know, the time to AML was much more prolonged. And so I'm already thinking maybe we should identify these patients, consider these agents, maybe consider these agents in combination. And rather than me just focusing on treating AML, maybe we should be trying to see if we can actually prevent AML in the future altogether, with these new agents being, you know, the start of a whole new set of possibilities of how to modify the microenvironment to make it more difficult for these MDS clones to ultimately transform. So I think this will be a new area. I mean, we've got a whole new field of CHIP, clonal hematopoiesis. Can we even go before the MDS and look at these drugs with similar possibilities, especially when they've got low toxicity? So for me, this really opens up the future of preventative medicine.
Fascinating. So Uma, you also in your talk went through some more data on the DEX-C for MDS. So before, as you comment on that, can you also respond to Hassan in the chat room who wants to know any rationale for combining luspatercept and EPO?
I think that's a great question. I think he's not the only one asking that question. I know that is something that is potentially being looked at and explored. And I think it goes to the fact that the biology and the way they may affect the disease is very different, even though there's obviously overlapping mechanisms and overlapping, you know, effects. And I think those studies are probably forthcoming, if not already ongoing.
So what about these two papers on DEX-C, particularly this issue of TP53? I mean, people are so interested in that. Any comments, Uma?
So I'm sure we'll reference this in the future slides as well. But as Andrew mentioned, you know, TP53 mutated myeloid malignancies are just very, very hard to treat. You know, they respond to therapy, whether it be Aza-Ven induction, and then the patients unfortunately relapse really quickly. We try to, you know, do as best as possible with taking patients to transplant with CPX351 and other therapies, but in general, they do poorly. So I thought that this was interesting because the oral DEX-C study, even though that was not the intent of the study, looked at a subset of TP53 mutated patients with biallelic TP53 mutations and tried to see, you know, how these patients did on the ASCERTAIN study. And what they found was there was maybe some hint that oral DEX-C might actually have some, I wouldn't say great responses, but definitely responses that seemed intriguing in TP53 mutated patients who typically do not really respond well to anything. So I thought that was a, you know, intriguing small subset of patients. And I'm sure, obviously, we need larger randomized studies that we'll be discussing shortly. I think the other study that's referenced here is a question that we already addressed a little bit in the AML section, is what is the right dose of oral DEX-C in our MDS patients, but particularly our low-risk MDS patients, where where they have low blast counts, they're more prolonged to have more prone to have cytopenias. Do we really need all 5 days? Do we really need the full dose of Dexy we use in AML? And this study, I think, was trying to address that question and is moving forward in a phase two study looking at different doses and schedules of oral Dexy to optimize that for our low-risk MDS patients.
So I feel like I should put this slide up and say, oh, now for the star of the show, but what about HMA venetoclax? Every oncologist is asking us about that for high-risk MDS. Here are several papers or so many others. Uma, can you talk a little bit about where we are with this concept?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think Andrew did such a fantastic job of discussing all of these things in AML. And in the MDS world, we really borrow and look to AML to try to, as Andrew said, intervene earlier and maybe prevent the progression to AML. And I think venetoclax with HMA combinations are a great example of how to do that in MDS, but not in the same way as we're doing in AML. And the studies on this slide really reference, you know, how to explore this in the phase one setting, where you take different doses and schedule of the HMA, different doses and schedules of venetoclax, and really optimize, as Andrew mentioned, the issue of prolonged cytopenias and the ability to keep delivering subsequent cycles to our MDS patients versus the efficacy where you want to get rid of those excess blasts, especially in the high-risk MDS patients, especially in the patients who are transplant candidates and have a donor lined up. And so these studies are really making those first attempts at finding that dose of that combination that's not toxic but effective. And it's also looking at it in the IV azacitidine setting, but then also in the oral combination setting where you have oral Dexy along with oral venetoclax, so an all-oral, really patient-friendly combination in terms of quality of life. The middle study that you see here that was led by Amer Zaidan is really looking at what do you do if patients stop responding to HMAs and progress? Can you use azacitidine and venetoclax in a way to salvage these patients? Relapse refractory MDS is a very difficult disease to treat. It's very challenging. And I think this paper really shows nicely that using the azacitidine plus 14-day venetoclax combinations, you can actually get some good responses and bridge patients to transplant.
Andrew, any thoughts? And also with this last subset of people who progress on HMA for high-risk MDS, is that a situation where you would think about low-dose IRC?
I think the data looks stronger for Ven-Aza in patients that have failed prior hypomethylating agents alone. And so across the board in MDS, I'm sort of dividing my patients into two groups. One, are we going to transplant? And if we are, I really think that this Ven-Aza combination has a really high response rate of about 80%, happens really quickly, one or two cycles. And so you can really deliver the patient to transplant very effectively that way, because we know that with Aza alone, going to transplant, about almost a third either don't get into remission or they progress before the transplant. And so that's a real problem, whereas Ven-Aza is highly effective. If the patient is not on a transplant trajectory, and particularly if they have P53 mutation, I think the field is moving more to thinking perhaps Ven-Aza is not the right combination to use for those patients, because P53 is such a potent resistance mechanism. And so I think that's a scenario where a single agent oral Dexy is, to me, more attractive. If I've got a patient that is old, that is frail, has P53, I can't cure the patient, transplant's not on the cards, Dexy is interesting, because many of us are starting to see some interesting responses with decitabine in this P53 mutant subgroup as a single agent. And so sometimes more is not better.
So Uma, you know, from a practical point of view, because there are people in practice trying to do this, one way or the other, one of the messages that I got from you is be very, very careful about cytopenias and the dose, and that MDS is not the same as AML in terms of HMA venetoclax. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. I just want to reiterate that message. As you know, we've talked about before, the dose of venetoclax and the duration that's moving forward in the MDS study, the high-risk MDS study, is 14 days of venetoclax at 400 milligrams. Obviously, the dose is different if you have concurrent azole therapy and so on and so forth. And even in that study and with those patients, we do see patients have prolonged cytopenias. They will need dose reductions in both the HMA and the venetoclax. And so my message is, I think there is absolutely a role for HMA-VEN in high-risk MDS. I think it's important to use it in patients, as Andrew said, that are identified as from the get-go as transplant candidates. You want to rapidly decrease the blasts, get them to transplant. Sometimes you can use it to salvage patients who've had single-agent HMA and then progressed. So to get them to transplant, but I would say use it with caution. Be very careful, monitor the patient closely, use your prophylactic antimicrobials, especially your azoles, and just be cautious. It is not still FDA approved or indicated in the United States, and there's a large randomized phase 3 study called the Verona study that has now completed accrual, and hopefully we'll have results from that soon, and that'll tell us a lot more information on how to use this combination.
So we already had a couple questions in the chat room about TIM-3, but before we get to that, Andrew, Venue has a case in the chat room that starts out with 87-year-old with AML. I can't resist that one. So no targetable mutations, treated with the cytobine-ven, progressed after 8 months. Is azacitidine at low dose of 6 mg/kg considered for this or alternative options still with ECOG-1?
Yeah, this is one of the highest unmet needs at the moment. Patients that fail Ven/Aza because the median survival in that group is about 3 months. So that's really a huge problem. Look, we also struggle with this group. We molecularly profile the patients. Is there a targetable IDH1, targetable FLT3, look for a clinical trial. In the absence of that, I don't have any magic wands for that patient group. Unfortunately, they are a huge problem, and I don't think any combination at this moment is showing clear benefit. Menin inhibitors, if they were available on trial, I think are really attractive in that group if they've got NPM1 or an MLL rearrangement.
You know, it's interesting. One of the most common reactions we get to our work is that people feel better when they see you struggle and you say, I don't know what to do. Then they feel better about the fact that they don't know what to do. So we could talk a long time about magrolimab and sabatolimab, Uma, but maybe just the bottom line and where we are with these two exciting agents. And, hopefully we're not going to be disappointed as we have in the past with other phase twos that didn't work out with phase three. Where are we with magrolimab and sabatolimab, Uma?
So just to remind your audience, magrolimab is an anti-CD47 antibody. And for those of who were wondering about the tumor biology, anti-CD47 is expressed on multiple cancers, and it sort of tells our immune system, especially your macrophages, to not to eat me. So don't eat me signal. So magrolimab, in its anti-CD47 antibody action, really exposes these tumor cells and facilitates or potentiates the action of azacitidine. Right now, we just had the phase 1b results published in JCO. And what we saw in this study was about 97 patients were treated. And in general, with 17 months follow-up, the overall survival hasn't been reached. But I think the more intriguing part with this combination is the CR rate was about 33% for the whole group, but 40% for the TP53 mutated subset of patients in the study. And the overall survival for those patients was about 16.3 months. So I think there's a signal there that maybe an anti-CD47 directed mechanism may be helpful, maybe more effective in TP53 mutated MDS. And I think that's where we're all very interested, as you said, in the ENHANCE study, which is a randomized phase 3 study that is completely accrued. And maybe we'll have results maybe even later this year, but more likely in 2024. The TIM-3 antibody called sabatolimab targets TIM-3, and TIM-3 is expressed on your leukemic stem cells, but it's also expressed on your immune effector cells like your T cells, your dendritic cells, and so on. So the hypothesis is it has sort of this kill two birds with one stone action where it targets the leukemic stem cells, but then it also stimulates the immune system to then recognize these cells and helps to potentiate the effect of the HMA that it's combined with. And right now, Andrew and myself are senior authors, and Andrew Bruner really led the study, the phase 1B study, combining this with HMAs. And this hopefully will be published soon, but has been presented multiple times, where we show that there's promising efficacy for this combination. We also had the Stimulus 1, which was a randomized phase 2 study presented by Amer Zeidan at ASH 2022, which unfortunately did not reach its primary endpoint at progression-free survival, but did seem to show some benefit for the combination in patients who actually continued to get HMA on schedule. And we are awaiting results of Stimulus 2, which is a large randomized phase 3 study looking at sabatolimab in this high-risk MDS population.
Andrew, any thoughts?
Yeah, we need magrolimab or sabatolimab to make it. We don't have any good new agents in MDS. Magrolimab in MDS with AZA, if that was positive, it would open up the field. And in AML, we're doing triplets of Ven-AZA with magrolimab. And particularly, we want that to work in P53 mutant AML. Even if it's not a cure, it'll be a first step to bigger and hopefully more effective things in the future. But these are critical pivotal studies that we're all waiting with bated breath for the results of.
So final comment from Uma. This is actually a negative study. It was one of the ones I was referring to that didn't work out with phase 3 with pevonedistat plus azacitidine. But the reason I'm showing it is you pointed out how well the control group did of just azacitidine. And that kind of leads into, before we were talking, before we got started, I asked you if there's anything you see people doing in practice in terms of using HMA in MDS that you think maybe you wouldn't do. I'm not going to say it's an error, but just things that maybe people ought to think about a little bit. How do you get the most out of HMA with MDS, Uma?
I think that is a great question. Thank you for asking that. I think the biggest thing that I see that maybe is an opportunity is you really need to give your HMA therapy for your MDS patients, especially your high-risk MDS patients, on schedule and on time for the first 3 to 4 cycles. And what I see happen is the patient is cytopenic and those cytopenias do not recover at those 28-day mark. And what happens is the patient's therapy is held, or the patient's therapy is dose reduced, or both. And I think we really need to recognize, to get the benefit off HMAs, you have to dose them at the right dose and right schedule for several cycles before you see a benefit. And I think the pevonedistat negative study showed us that when that was done in the control azacitidine arm, patients actually did really well.
So Uma and Andrew, thank you so much for working with us on this project. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back next Wednesday. Want to hear what Dr. Hurvitz has to say about HER2-low and breast cancer and the use of T-DXd. Guess what? There's a press release out. Now we have another CDK trial that's positive in the adjuvant setting. I want to hear what she has to say about that and a lot more. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Uma. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Bye.